Was it possible, he sometimes said to himself, that despite all their enormous intelligence, the overlords did not really understand mankind, and were making a terrible mistake from the best of motives? Suppose, in their altruistic passion for justice and order, they had determined to reform the world, but had not realized that they were destroying the soul of man? The decline had barely started, yet the FTRST symptoms of decay were not hard to discover. Salomon was no artist, but he had an acute appreciation of art and knew that his age could riot match the achievements of previous centuries in any single field. Perhaps matters would right themselves in due course, when the shock of encountering the overlord civilization had worn off. But it might not, and a prudent man would consider taking out an insurance policy. New Athens was that policy. Its establishment had taken 20 years and some billions of pounds decimal dot a relatively trivial factor, therefore, of the world's total wealth. Nothing had happened for the first 15 years, everything had happened in the last 5. Salomon's task would have been impossible had he not been able to convince a handful of the world's most famous artists that his plan was sound. They had sympathized because it appealed to their egos, not because it was important for the 126th race. But, once convinced, the world had listened to them and given both moral and material support. Behind this spectacular facade of temperamental talent, the real architects of the colony had laid their plans. A society consists of human beings whose behavior as individuals is unpredictable. But if one takes enough of the basic units, then certain laws begin to appear, as was discovered long ago by life insurance companies. One can tell what individuals will die in a given time, yet the total number of deaths can be predicted with considerable accuracy. There are other, subtler laws, first glimpsed in the early 20th century by mathematicians such as Wiener and Rashevsky. They had argued that such events as economic depressions, the results of armament races, the stability of social groups, political elections, and so on could be analyzed by the correct mathematical techniques. The great difficulty was the enormous number of variables, many of them hard to define in numerical terms. One could not draw a set of curves and state definitely, when this line is reached, it will mean war. And one could never wholly allow for such utterly unpredictable events as the assassination of a key figure or the effects of some new scientific discovery. Still less such natural catastrophes as earthquakes or floods, which might have a profound effect on large numbers of people and the social groups in which they lived. Yet one could do much, thanks to the knowledge patiently accumulated during the past 100 years. The task would have been impossible without the aid of the giant computing machines that could perform the work of 1,000 human calculators in a matter of seconds. Such aids had been used to the utmost when the colony was planned. Even so, the founders of New Athens could only provide the soil and the climate in which the plant they wished to cherish might or might not come to flower. As Salomon himself had remarked, "We can be sure of talent, we can only pray for genius." But it was a reasonable hope that in such a concentrated solution some interesting reactions would take place. Few artists thrive in solitude, and nothing is more stimulating than the conflict of minds with similar interests. So far, the conflict had produced worthwhile results in sculpture, music, literary criticism and film-making. It was still too early to see if the group working on historical research 127 would fulfill the hopes of its instigators, who were frankly aiming at restoring mankind's pride in its own achievements. Painting still languished, which supported the view of those who considered that static, two-dimensional forms of art had no further possibilities. It was noticeable, though a satisfactory explanation FBR this had not yet been produced, that time played an essential part in their colony's most successful artistic achievements. Even its sculpture was seldom immobile. Andrew Carson's intriguing volumes and curves changed slowly as one watched, according to complex patterns that the mind could appreciate, even if it could not fully comprehend them. Indeed, Carson claimed, with some truth, to have taken the mobiles of a century before to their ultimate conclusion, and thus to have wedded sculpture and ballet. Much of the colony's musical experimenting was, quite consciously, concerned with what might be called time span. What was the briefest note that the mind could grasp, or the longest that it could tolerate without boredom? Could the result be varied by conditioning or by the use of appropriate orchestration? Such problems were discussed endlessly, and the arguments were not purely academic. They had resulted in some extremely interesting compositions. But it was in the art of the cartoon film, with its limitless possibilities, that New Athens had made its most successful experiments. The 100 years since the time of Disney had still left much undone in this most flexible of all mediums. On the purely realistic side, results could be produced indistinguishable from actual photography. Much to the contempt of those who were developing the cartoon along abstract lines. The group of artists and scientists that had so far done least was the one that had attracted the greatest interest and the greatest alarm. This was the team working on total identification. The history of the cinema gave the clue to their actions. First, sound, then color, then stereoscopy, then Cinerama, had made the old moving pictures more and more like reality itself. Where was the end of the story? Surely, the final stage would be reached when the audience forgot it was an audience, and became part of the action. To achieve this would involve stimulation of all the senses, and perhaps H noses as WCLL, but many believed it to be practical. When goal was attained, there would be an enormous enrichment of 128 human experience. A man could become for a while, at least any other person, and could take part in any conceivable adventure, real or imaginary. He could even be plant or animal, if it proved possible to capture and record the sense impressions of other living creatures. And when the program was over, he would have acquired a memory as vivid as any experience in his actual life. Indeed, indistinguishable from reality itself. The prospect was dazzling. Many also found it terrifying, and hoped that the enterprise would fail. But they knew in their hearts that once science had declared a thing possible, there was no escape from its eventual realization. This, then, was New Athens and some of its dreams. It hoped to become what the old Athens might have been had it possessed machines instead of slaves, science instead of superstition. But it was much too early yet to tell if the experiment would succeed. 16 Jmi Luigi Igson was one islander who, as yet, had no interest in aesthetics or science, the two main preoccupations of his elders. But he heartily approved of the colony, for purely personal reasons. The sea, never more than a few kilometers away in any direction, fascinated him. Most of his short life had been spent far inland, and he was not yet accustomed to the novelty of being surrounded by water. He was a good swimmer, and would often cycle off with other young friends, carrying his fins and mask, to go exploring the shallower water of the lagoon. At first Jean was not very happy about this, but after she had made a few dives herself, she lost her fear of the sea and its strange creatures and let Geoffrey enjoy himself as he pleased, on condition that he never swam alone. The other member of the Gregson household who approved of the change was Faye, the beautiful golden retriever who nominally belonged to George, but could seldom be detached from Geoffrey. The two were inseparable, both by day and if Jean had not put her foot down by night. Only when Geoffrey went off on his bicycle did Faye remain at home, lying listlessly in front of the door and staring down the road 129 with moist, mournful eyes, her muzzle resting on her paws. This was rather mortifying to George, who had paid a stiff price for Faye and her pedigree. It looked as if he would have to wait for the next generation due in 3 months before he could have a dog of his own. Jean had other views on the subject. She liked Faye, but felt that one hound perhaps was quite sufficient. Only Jennifer Ann had not yet decided whether she liked the colony. That, however, was hardly surprising, for she had so far seen nothing of the world beyond the plastic panels of her cot, and had, as yet, very little suspicion that such a place existed. George Gregson did not often think about the past. He was too busy with plans for the future, too much occupied by his work and his children. It was rare indeed that his mind went back across the years to that evening in Africa, and he never talked about it with Jean. By mutual consent, the subject was avoided, and since that day they had never visited the Boyces again, despite repeated invitations. They called Rupert with fresh excuses several times a year, and lately he had ceased to bother them. His marriage to Maya, rather to everyone's surprise, still seemed to be flourishing. One result of that evening was that Jean had lost all desire to dabble with mysteries at the borders of known science. The naive and uncritical wonder that had drawn her to Rupert and his experiments had completely vanished. Perhaps she had been convinced and wanted no more proof. George preferred not to ask her. It was just as likely that the cares of maternity had banished such interests from her mind. There was no point, George knew, in worrying about a mystery that could never be solved, yet sometimes in the stillness of the night he would wake and wonder. He remembered his meeting with Jan Rodericks on the roof of Rupert's house, and the few words that were all he had spoken with the only human being successfully to defy the Overlord's ban. Nothing in the realm of the supernatural, thought George, could be more eerie than the plain scientific fact that though almost 10 years had passed since he had spoken to Jan, that now far distant voyager would have aged by only a few days. The universe was vast, but that fact terrified him less than its 130 mystery. George was not a person who thought deeply on such matters, yet sometimes it seemed to him that men were like children amusing themselves in some secluded playground, protected from the fierce realities of the outer world. Jan Rodericks had resented that protection and had escaped from it. Into no dot one knew what. But in this matter George found himself on the side of the overlords. He had no wish to face whatever one lurked in the unknown darkness, just beyond the little circle of light cast by the lamp of science. "How is it," said George plaintively, "that Jeff's always off somewhere when I happen to be home? Where's he gone today?" Jean looked up from her knitting, an archaic occupation which had recently been revived with much success. Such fashions came and went on the island with some rapidity. The main result of this particular craze was that the men had now all been presented with multi-colored sweaters, far too hot to wear in the daytime but quite useful after sundown. "He's gone off to Sparta with some friends," Jean replied. "He promised to be back for dinner." "I really came home to do some work," said George thoughtfully. "But it's a nice day, and I think I'll go out there and have a swim myself. What kind of fish would you like me to bring back?" George had never caught anything, and the fish in the lagoon were much too wily to be trapped. Jean was just going to point this out when the stillness of the afternoon was shattered by a sound that still had power, even in this peaceful age, to chill the blood and set the scalp crawling with apprehension. It was the wail of a siren, rising and filling, spreading its message of danger in concentric circles out to sea. For almost 100 years the stresses had been slowly increasing, here in the burning darkness deep beneath the ocean's floor. Though the submarine canyon had been formed geological ages ago, the tortured rocks had never reconciled themselves to their new positions. Countless times the strata had creaked and shifted, as the unimaginable weight of water disturbed their precarious equilibrium. They were ready to move again. 131 Jeff was exploring the rock pools along the narrow Spartan beach, an occupation he found endlessly absorbing. One never knew what exotic creatures one might find, sheltered here from the waves that marched forever across the Pacific to spend themselves against the reef. It was a fairyland for any child, and at the moment he possessed it all himself, for his friends had gone up into the hills. The day was quiet and peaceful. There was not a breath of wind, and even the perpetual muttering beyond the reef had sunk to a sullen undertone. A blazing sun hung half-way down the sky, but Jeff's mahogany-brown body was now quite immune to its onslaughts. The beach here was a narrow belt of sand, sloping steeply towards the lagoon. Looking down into the glass-clear water, Jeff could see the submerged rocks which were as familiar to him as any formations on the land. About 10 meters down, the weed-covered ribs of an ancient schooner curved up towards the world it had left almost 2 centuries ago. Jeff and his friends had often explored the wreck, but their hopes of hidden treasure had been disappointed. All that they had ever retrieved was a barnacle-encrusted compass. Very firmly, something took hold of the beach and gave it a single, sudden jerk. The tremor passed so swiftly that Jeff wondered if he had imagined it. Perhaps it was a momentary giddiness, for all around him remained utterly unchanged. The waters of the lagoon were unruffled, the sky empty of cloud or menace. And then a very strange thing began to happen. Swifter than any tide could ebb, the water was receding from the shore. Jeff watched, deeply puzzled and not in the least afraid, as the wet sands were uncovered and lay sparkling in the sun. He followed the retreating ocean, determined to make the most of whatever miracle had opened up the underwater world for his inspection. Now the level had sunk so far that the broken mast of the old wreck was climbing into the air, its weeds hanging limply from it as they lost their liquid support. Jeff hastened forward, eager to see what wonders would be uncovered next. It was then that he noticed the sound from the reef. He had never heard anything like it before, only he stopped to think the matter over, his bare feet slowly sinking into the moist sand. A great fish was thrashing in its death agonies a few 132 meters away, but Jeff scarcely noticed it. He stood, alert and listening, while the noise from the reef grew steadily around him. It was a sucking, gurgling sound, as of a river racing through a narrow channel. It was the voice of the reluctantly retreating sea, angry at losing, even for a moment, the lands it rightfully possessed. Through the graceful branches of the coral, through the hidden submarine caves, millions of tons of water were draining out of the lagoon into the vastness of the Pacific. Very soon, and very swiftly, they would return. One of the salvage parties, hours later, found Jeff on a great block of coral that had been hurled 20 meters above the normal water level. He did not seem particularly frightened, though he was upset over the loss of his bicycle. He was also very hungry, as the partial destruction of the causeway had cut him off from home. When rescued, he was contemplating swimming back to Athens, and, unless the currents had changed drastically, would doubtless have managed the cross-big without much trouble. Jean and George had witnessed the whole sequence of events when the tsunami hit the island. Though the damage to the low-lying areas of Athens had been severe, there had been no loss of life. The seismographs had been able to give only 15 minutes warning, but that had been long enough to get everyone above the danger line. Now the colony was licking its wounds and collecting together a mass of legends that would grow steadily more hair-raising through the years to come. Jean burst into tears when her son was restored to her, for she had quite convinced herself that he had been swept out to sea. She had watched with horrified eyes as the black and foam-capped wall of water had moved roaring in from the horizon to smother the base of Sparta in spume and spray. It seemed incredible that Jeff could have reached safety in time. It was scarcely surprising that he could not give a very rational account of what had happened. When he had eaten and was safely in bed, Jean and George gathered by his side. "Go to sleep, darling, and forget all about it," said Jean. "You're all right now." 133 "But it was fun, Mummy," protested Jeff. "I wasn't really one way frightened." "That's fine," said George. "You're a brave lad, and it's a good thing you were sensible and ran in time. I've heard about these tidal waves before. A lot of people get drowned because they go out on the uncovered beach to see what's happened." "That's what I did," confessed Jeff. "I wonder who it was helped me."
"What do you mean?"
"There wasn't anyone with you. The other boys were up the bill." Jeff looked puzzled.
But someone told me to run. Jean and George glanced at each other in mild alarm.
You mean dot you imagined you heard something?
Oh, don't bother him now, said Jean anxiously, and with a little too much haste.
But George was stubborn. I want to get to the bottom of this.
Tell me just till that happened, Jeff.
Well, I was right down the beach, by that old wreck, when the voice spoke.
What did it say?
I can't quite remember, but it was something like, Jeffrey, get up the hill as quickly as you can. You'll be drowned if you stay here. I'm sure it called me Jeffrey, not Jeff.
So it couldn't have been anyone I knew.
Was it a man's voice?
And where did it come from?
It was ever so close beside me.
And it sounded like a man.
Jeff hesitated for a moment, and George prompted him.
Go on, Dot, just imagine that you're back on the beach, and tell us exactly what happened.
Well, it wasn't quite like anyone I've ever heard talking before. I think he was a very big man.
Is that all the voice said?
Yes, Dot, until I started to climb the hill.
Then another funny thing happened.
You know the path up the cliff?
Yes.
I was running up that, because it was the quickest way.
I knew what was happening now, for I'd seen the big wave coming in.
It was making an awful noise, too.
And then I found there was a great big rock in the way.
It wasn't there before, and I couldn't get past it.
134 The quake must have brought it down, said George.
Shush.
Go on, Jeff.
I didn't know what to do, and I could hear the wave coming closer.
Then the voice said, close your eyes, Jeffrey, and put your hand in front of your face.
It seemed a funny thing to do, but I tried it.
And then there was a great flash. Dot, I could feel it all over. Dot, and when I opened my eyes, the rock was gone.
Gone?
That's right, Dot, it just wasn't there.
So I started running again, and that's when I nearly burnt my feet, because the path was awful hot.
The water hissed when it went over it, but it couldn't catch me then. Dot, I was too far up the cliff.
And that's all. I came down again when there weren't any more waves.
Then I found that my bike had gone, and the road home had been knocked down.
Don't worry about the bicycle, dear, said Jean, squeezing her son thankfully.
We'll get you another one.
The only thing that matters is that
you're safe.
We won't worry about how it happened.
That wasn't true, of course, for the conference began immediately they had left the nursery.
It decided nothing, but it bad two sequels.
The next day, without telling George, Jean took her small son to the colony's child psychologist. He listened carefully while Jeff repeated his story, not in the least overawed by his novel surroundings.
Then, while his unsuspecting patient rejected seriatim the toys in the next room, the doctor reassured Jean.
There's nothing on his card to suggest any mental abnormality.
You must remember that he's been through a terrifying experience, and he's come out of it remarkably well.
He's a highly imaginative child, and probably believes his own story.
So just accept it, and don't worry unless there are any later symptoms.
Then let me know at once.
That evening, Jean passed the verdict on to her husband.
He did not seem as relieved as she had hoped, and she put it down to worry over the damage to his beloved theater.
He just grunted that's fine and settled down with the current issue of stage and studio.
It looked as if he had lost interest in the whole affair, and Jean felt vaguely annoyed with him.
But 3 weeks later, on the first day that the causeway was reopened, George and his bicycle set off briskly towards Sparta.
135 The beach was still littered with masses of shattered coral, and in one place the reef itself seemed to have been breached.
George wondered how long it would take the myriads of patient polyps to repair the damage.
There was only one path up the face of the cliff, and when he had recovered his breath, George began the climb.
A few dried fragments of weed, trapped among the rocks, marked the limit of the ascending waters.
For a long time George Gregson stood on that lonely track, staring at the patch of fused rock beneath his feet. He tried to tell himself that it was some freak of the long-dead volcano, but soon abandoned this attempt at self-deception. His mind went back to that night, years ago, when he and Jean had joined that silly experiment of Rupert Boyce's. No one had ever really understood what had happened then, and George knew that in some unfathomable way these two strange events were linked together. First it had been Jean, now her son. He did not know whether to be glad or fearful, and in his heart he uttered a silent prayer, "Thank you, Care Ellen, for whatever your people did for Jeff. But I wish I knew why they did it." He went slowly down to the beach, and the great white gulls wheeled around him, annoyed because he had brought no food to throw them as they surged in the sky. 17 Q-S request, though it might have been expected at any time since the foundation of the colony, was something of a bombshell. It represented, as everyone was fully aware, a crisis in the affairs of Athens, and nobody could decide whether good or bad would come of it. Until now, the colony had gone its way without any form of interference from the overlords. They had left it completely alone, as indeed they ignored most human activities that were not subversive or did not offend their codes of behavior. Whether the colony's aims could be called subversive was uncertain. They were non-political, but they represented a bid for intellectual and artistic independence. And from that, who knew what might come? The overlords might well be 136 able to foresee the future of Athens more clearly than its founders, and they might not like it. Of course, if Care Ellen wished to send an observer, inspector, or whatever one cared to call him, there was nothing that could be done about it. 20 years ago the overlords had announced that they had discontinued all use of their surveillance devices, so that humanity need no longer consider itself spied upon. However, the fact that such devices still existed meant that nothing could be hidden from the overlords if they really wanted to see it. There were some on the island who welcomed this visit as a chance of settling one of the minor problems of overlord psychology. Their attitude towards art. Did they regard it as a childish aberration of the human race? Did they have any forms of art themselves? In that case, was the purpose of this visit purely aesthetic, or did Care Ellen have less innocent motives? All these matters were debated endlessly while the preparations were underway. Nothing was known of the visiting overlord, but it was assumed that he could absorb culture in unlimited amounts. The experiment would at least be attempted, and the reactions of the victim observed with interest by a battery of very shrewd minds. The current chairman of the council was the philosopher, Charles Janssen, an ironic but fundamentally cheerful man who was not yet in his 60s and was therefore still in the prime of life. Plato would have approved of him as an example of the philosopher-statesman, though Sen did not altogether approve of Plato, whom he suspected of grossly misrepresenting Socrates. He was one of the islanders who was determined to make the most of this visit, if only to show the overlords that men still had plenty of initiative and were not yet, as he put it, fully domesticated. Nothing in Athens was done without a committee, that ultimate hallmark of the democratic method. Indeed, someone had once defined the colony as a system of interlocking committees. But the system worked, thanks to the patient studies of the social psychologists who had been the real founders of Athens. Because the community was not too large, everyone in it could take some part in its running and could be a citizen in the truest sense of the word. It was almost inevitable that George, as a leading member 137 of the artistic hierarchy, should be one of the reception committee. But he made doubly sure by pulling a few strings. If the overlords wanted to study the colony, George wanted equally to study them. Jean was not very happy about this. Ever since that evening at the Boyce's, she had felt a vague hostility towards the overlords, though she could never give any reason for it. She just wished to have as little to do with them as possible, and to her one of the island's main attractions had been its hope for independence. Now she feared that this independence might be threatened. The overlord arrived without ceremony in an ordinary man-made flyer, to the disappointment of those who had hoped for something more spectacular. He might have been Kaer Ellen himself, for no one had ever been able to distinguish one overlord from another with any degree of confidence. They all seemed duplicates from a single master mold. Perhaps, by some unknown biological process, they were,